is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rand Paul has announced that he's running for president yesterday. It happened during our show. And the question, you know, A, is he actually libertarian? B, what the heck does that mean? C, is there any possibility that he could successfully run for president based on that? And, you know, D, where does all this go? C. Edmund Wright is with us. He's the author of WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. Contributor to Newsmax TV, Breitbart, The American Thinker. His website, C. Edmund, E-D-M-U-N-D, Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T.com. And Mr. Wright, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be back.
Great to have you with us. First of all, your thoughts on Rand Paul's run for the presidency. I'm assuming you're a self-described libertarian.
I would be a conservative with libertarian leanings.
Okay.
Or a libertarian with conservative leanings, whatever your, you know, how you want to say it.
Sure.
We knew he was going to run. I quite frankly think he's had two horrible years of pandering over here and flip-flopping over there. And he's trying to, it seems to me, Tom, he's trying to craft a niche of his libertarian base that he kind of gets from his father, and then pick up some Berkeley hippies over here and some African Americans the way Thad Cochran did. And I think he's trying to niche his way to a nomination, but I don't see him expanding beyond the Ron Paul base. And in fact, he may not even equal that.
Well, both parties do this. I mean, they both kind of niche their way to things. The Democratic Party tends to do it with issues like labor and food safety and housing and things. And the Republicans tend to do it with things like, you know, God, gays, and guns.
I agree with that. And I think the way the Democrat Party is structured, that works for them. And I agree the Republican establishment thinks it works for them, but knocking down the idea that the way Republicans win is to niche your way, it was basically the general thesis of my book.
Yeah. Do you if I could digress for a second. Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a Democrat Party, just FYI. It's called the Democratic Party. It was named by Thomas Jefferson, and the Democrat Party was a slur that was introduced by – who is that guy who, you know, have you no shame, Senator, back in the 50s? Yeah, Joe McCarthy. Yeah, he came up with that, and he said Republicans should always refer to it as the Democrat Party and emphasize the rap part. Just FYI.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, well, that's the history. And that's why the partisan Republicans constantly refer to it as the Democrat Party, even though there is no such thing. But it seems to me, back to Rand Paul, it seems to me that what he's saying, not so much to Republicans, but to the American electorate right across the board, is I will take you back, you know, we'll do the libertarian thing. We will take you back to the economic policies that that Warren Harding proclaimed in 1920 when he ran on a campaign platform of less government and business, more business and government. In other words, privatize and deregulate. And also he cut the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%. And Paul's talking about the 17% flat tax. That he's going to take us back to the roaring 20s or take us back to the Gilded Age economically. And in exchange for that, he wants the Republicans to give up spying on us, imprisoning us in these extraordinary numbers that have exploded since Reagan put Nixon's drug war on steroids. And that, you know, Republicans have to stop being so enthusiastic about sending their young people off to war. I mean, it's sort of like taking the Republican Party back to pre-World War II. The Republicans, of course, many Republicans strongly opposed our entrance into World War II up until, you know, Pearl Harbor. Is that a deal that will work in your mind?
No. And actually, I think your description's pretty accurate as to what he's trying to do. But no, I don't think it's going to work. I think that's going to kind of just isolate him to the Ron Paul, Rand Paul base. Yeah. I don't see him expanding much past that. I don't see him competing with Ted Cruz for a lot of the Tea Party voters, with the exception of kind of the hardcore Paul libertarian group of that. And that's part of the Tea Party movement, but only a slice of it. I think over time, He's not going to measure up anywhere close to Walker or Cruz. And of course, then Jeb Bush is going to have the big money machine. And I told you, I think months ago, Tom, I think on this show that I thought eventually Ted Cruz would win the nomination. I'm still predicting that. It has very little to do with where he is today. It's just my gauge of how a message will sell over time. And I think over time, Rand Paul's message is not going to sell.
Right. I think you might be right. In fact, I think you're most likely right. And from my point of view, the main reason why his message won't sell is that people like myself, who might even be inclined to vote, it's going to take a heck of a lot to make me vote for a Republican, but might be inclined to vote for somebody who commits to shutting down the national security state, except in those areas where we actually want it to be, you know, working, who commits to no more wars, who commits to, genuine criminal justice reform. That sounds pretty good. But those are things that liberals have been calling for forever. I mean, basically.
Well, you're right. And this is the conundrum that Rand Paul doesn't seem to understand. You can make Tom Hartman and his listeners and viewers a little more interested than they are in any other Republican. And maybe you can get louder cheers in front of 400 folks at Berkeley than any other Republican.
Right.
But none of those people are going to ever vote for Rand Paul, and certainly not any other Republican.
Well, and here's the other half of the big problem is that, Rand Paul used to say, let's not have a war with Iran. Back when John McCain in 2008 was saying bomb, bomb, bomb Iran, Rand Paul was saying that's stupid. We need to negotiate with them. That's what you do with your enemies. That's what Reagan did with the Soviet Union. Now he's saying, oh, you know, the president's deal is a lousy deal. We need to go back to bombing Iran. I mean, not literally those words, but certainly implying that. Because this Swift Boat group started running ads trashing him for being in favor of Obama's position. It's like, in other words, I don't trust him to actually do what he says he's going to do, because he's been all over the map so many times on so many things.
See, you and I agree on Rand Paul. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Okay. So, Ted Cruz, I'm scratching my head on. My money's on Jeb Bush just because he's got the money, and that's, you know, according to the Supreme Court, that's all it takes these days. Real quickly, what would a libertarian response be to somebody who, say, gets cancer and is looking at a couple $100,000 worth of surgery and chemotherapy? How do libertarians deal with that?
Well, first of all, you got a lot of proclaimed libertarians are probably libertarian on one or two hot button issues and really don't understand Randian, as in Ayn Rand, not Rand Paul, Randian libertarianism. Neil Bortz, the radio host, claims to be a libertarian, but he steps on that all the time with his particular views.
Well, Ayn Rand took Medicare. She treated her own lung cancer with Medicare, with federal funds.
Well, it's hard to come through with a pure libertarian view in a world where that's not where we live. I think the pure libertarian view would probably be government has no role. But, of course, you cannot undo all of that in our healthcare system now.
So the answer to somebody who's facing a couple $100,000 worth of medical bills or or dying because they can't come up with the money from a libertarian point of view is good luck. See you in heaven.
Well, that may be the pure libertarian view. I think there are people who get money raised to help that happen. And actually,
so the libertarian view is GoFundMe?
Well, the healthcare Obamacare debate, which I'd love to have, but
yeah.
I guess I can't answer the pure libertarian view. I'm not a pure libertarian.
Okay, and as you correctly point out, it would take more time than we have. Yeah. C. Edmund Wright, always interesting, always nice talking with you. CEdmundWright.com, the website. Thanks, and author of WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. And it's going to be interesting to see if they lose this one. Mr. Wright, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Anytime.
Good talking. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Meanwhile, yesterday, we have this police officer being indicted for shooting a black man. I got a rant about this I want to share with you. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Brian, watching Free Speech TV in Fitchburg, Mass. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
I heard Ron Paul, talk about how he's going to help the poor.
Uh-huh.
He didn't say how he's going to do it. And another thing I want to say is, about this police shooting.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, all the police departments are going to say, make sure there's nobody around to take pitches ever again.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about that at some length after the next break. But, yeah.
Well, you know, Grant Paul talked. I listened to him speak. I didn't hear him say anything he's going to do. It's like he's rambling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, like our tax policy. They say we spend 2% of our taxes on the military. You know, they shouldn't count Medicare and Social Security because that's not a tax.
Right. It's you're right. Those are insurance programs that we pay into and we get our money back out of, and they are separate from the budget. Yeah, and it's a heck of a lot more than 2% of your money goes to the military budget. I think I could be wrong, but I think it's somewhere I believe it's in the neighborhood of a quarter of the entire federal budget, and maybe even half. I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while since I've had the old graphs and charts out. But, Brian, thanks for the call, and good talking with you. Archie, watching Free Speech TV in Yucca Valley, California. Hey, Archie, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share a little experience. I saw the film about the policeman shooting the running man in the back.
Right.
20 years ago, I had a neighbor. He was a retired captain of a police force, and as I got to know him over the years, one day he asked me if because I collected a few guns, he asked me if I was interested in possibly buying some pistol. He had quite a few. He brought over this big canvas bag one day, and he had about 35 very small pistols.
Wow.
He started telling me the story. They would take them off. If they got a guy with a pistol on him, if they couldn't turn him into a confidential informant and just do away with that gun charge, well, then they would charge him.
Right.
Literally, this man, I'm not going to say any names or police forces, this bag was full of guns over his career that he had confiscated and what they were used for. If they had a bad shoot, they dropped them on the victim.
Right. Like this cop did with his taser on the...
When I saw that this morning and they highlighted the taser, he ran back and picked it up, must have dropped it. Another thing, Tom, real quick. I don't know if many people know something about guns. You do. It's almost like we walked on a trip. You even went door-to-door in 64 for Barry Goldwater with your dad.
Yeah.
I did, too. Do you remember one thing we always left when we left the home?
Refresh my memory.
I don't know if you ever did it. I did it for two or three Saturdays. It was folding up papers, putting them in envelopes to send out information to the voters, and we always left like four or five pages, you know, stapled, that people could read.
Oh, yeah.
You have your cheat sheets there, your topic headings. Every reporter does.
Yeah.
I don't know the last time I got any kind of detailed anything in the mail. I'm an independent.
Yeah.
Nobody sends me any information.
No, we used to have, you know, party platforms that people actually believed in and policy statements that they actually followed. You're right, Archie. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Okay, I want to change the topic here somewhat from Rand Paul and libertarians. Although we can continue to talk about this as time goes on. My whole thing of most libertarians or people who think they're libertarians don't have a clue what this means and all that sort of thing. But there was this police shooting, and it's in a way it's. In a lot of ways, actually, it's axiomatic of something much, much larger. This is in the town of North Charleston, North Carolina. Or is it South Carolina? South Carolina. North Charleston, South Carolina. Michael Thomas Slager was the police officer. Excuse me, Mike Slager. And he's being charged with first degree murder now in the death of Walter Scott. Walter Scott had... it had been in and out of trouble that mostly had to do with child support payments and stuff like that, or not paying fines for traffic tickets, which is, I mean, this is how you've got a community that is 47% black, only 37% white, and a police force that's 80% white. And that, you know, just like in Ferguson, that how do you squeeze money out of the locals? You stop them for any little thing, hit them with a traffic fine. If they don't pay it, it becomes a court cost. If they don't pay that, they go to jail. And this guy, Walter Scott, who was stopped, was in that position where he had enough fines that he hadn't paid that he might be going to jail, and he ran away. Now, running away, you know, police officers are only supposed to be able to discharge their weapons in order to, you know, prevent grave bodily injury or death to themselves or another person. Somebody running away doesn't qualify. That's what you call other police officers for. You chase people down, whatever. But, you know, running away, no. And for 2 days, we didn't know that this video existed. And this cop, Mike Slager, was out there pushing his version of what happened. The Post and Courier dutifully reported the story via the police department. Police, in a matter of hours, declared the occurrence at the corner of Remount and Craig Roads a traffic stop gone wrong, alleging the dead man fought with an officer over his taser before deadly force was employed. By the way, prediction. Fox News today will be talking about how there must have been a struggle over the taser, otherwise it wouldn't have ended up on the ground, right? And so, therefore, this was justified. Just a prediction. Statement released by North Charleston police spokesman Spencer Pryor said a man ran on foot from the traffic stop. Officer deployed his department-issued taser in an attempt to stop him. That did not work, police said, and an altercation ensued as the men struggled over the device. See, this is the official story before the video came out. Police alleged that during the struggle, a man gained control of the taser and attempted to use it against the officer. The officer then resorted to his service weapon and shot him, police alleged. Slager thinks, again, on Monday, before the video came out, the local paper said, Slager thinks he properly followed all procedures and policies before resorting to deadly force, said his lawyer, David Aylor, who apparently is no longer his lawyer. He says, when confronted, Officer Slager reached for his taser. Well, you know the story. The thing that is astonishing to me about this is, frankly and basically, the white privilege piece of this. Walter Scott, in my opinion, Walter Scott would not be dead if he was white. He might not have even been stopped for a traffic stop if he was white. And this goes way beyond police killings. This goes to all of the day by day microaggressions, all the things that go along with a community of people who are not the recipients of white privilege or even white male privilege. A whole other piece I'm going to get to a little later on in the program about a woman named Alex who had been blogging about feminist issues with her identity on Twitter as a woman and a picture of her as a woman. She changed it for a week to a pictures of a man, and her name is Alex, so people would think she was, and her identity is male. And suddenly people weren't threatening to rape her. They weren't threatening to beat her up. They weren't calling her the B word or the C word. They were having rational conversations with her. But there's that issue. That very real issue in this country that we haven't dealt with, you know, the race issue. But I would say that one of the linchpin pieces of it that the media is so afraid to go near, and the Bill Riley to this day continues to assert doesn't even exist. By the way, did you see MediaMatters.org has a new book out about Bill O'Reilly's lies? Check it out over at MediaMatters.org. Anyhow, that whole thing is contingent on a social construct which ignores white male privilege and, you know, doesn't have discussions about it, doesn't do education about it, doesn't try to do anything about it at law, simply allows it to continue. And I think that a town that is only 37% white, it's got a police force that's 80% white, the cop thinks, hey, it's a black guy, I can just kill him. This is, I mean, you know, I believe on average around 3 people a day in America are killed by police. How often does this happen?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I mean, frankly, even once is way too often, but presumably it's more than once. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. How do we get white people to understand white privilege? It's... I mean, this is like a real challenge for me in some ways. I briefly told this story yesterday, although I think I told it during one of our breaks, so perhaps a lot of our listeners didn't hear it. A while back, and I think I've told this story before, a while back I was shopping in a store here in town, and the clerk was African-American, and it was a department store. Actually, this has happened to me now 4 or 5 times in the 4 years that I've lived in Washington, D.C., a deeply multiracial city. Pretty much every city I've lived in prior to now, at least the parts of the town that I've lived in, have been basically all white. And I live now in an area, the community I live in is racially integrated, the neighborhood I live in is heavily racially integrated, and the city is. And which has led to my education. And in this particular situation, and again, I even had this happen once in a fast food restaurant, but this was in a department store. And my recollection is I was buying a pair of gloves. I think it was this last fall as it was starting to get cold at one of the department stores here in downtown Washington, D.C. And the clerk was African-American, and I paid for the gloves. And then I just pulled the label off and stuck them in my pocket. And she tried to hand me the receipt, and I said, I don't need the receipt. And she had this just horrified look on her face, like, you know, you could be stopped for shoplifting. And I said, well, the tag's been taken off it. And, you know, I've been on this planet more than 6 decades, and I have never been stopped for shoplifting. Never been. And I didn't give her the whole speech, but, you know, it's like I said, I'm not worried about it. And whoa. And I think a person of color would have said, yeah, I'll take that receipt all the way out the front door, and maybe even a few blocks down the street. Because you're more likely to be accused of shoplifting. I mean, these are this is a whole lot more subtle than being shot in the back by a cop 8 times. But these are the indignities visited on a daily basis. Actually, let me reverse that. These are the privileges, the privilege of not having to worry about a receipt. Right? I'd say, you know, if I buy something in a store, more often than not, if I don't have to walk out with a bag, if I can just take the thing and very often just tear it out of its packaging and toss the packaging in the trash in the store and walk out with it in my jacket pocket in the spring, fall, and winter, I'll do that. How many people of color can do that? What's your experience been? And then it gets even stranger. Ever heard of Ramsey Orta? Ramsey Orta is the guy who videotaped the police murder of Eric Garner in New York City, in Long Island. Was it Staten Island, as I recall? Ramsey Orta was the guy who videotaped that. According to the Free Thought Project, thefreethoughtproject.com, John Vibes, independent journalist, he says the 22-year-old Ramsey Orta, the young man who filmed the NYPD killing Eric Garner, was arrested shortly after on trumped-up charges. He's since been locked up in the notorious Rikers Prison in New York. He was stalked and targeted by the police. They allegedly scrutinized Orta's daily life until they were able to find something to charge him with. Eventually, he was confronted by police who illegally searched him and arrested him for the nonviolent crime of carrying an unregistered firearm. It's not a good thing to do, but still. Orta had expressed concern for his safety after his arrest because he was sure that the police were retaliating against him for exposing what they had done to Eric Garner. So he refused to eat in the jail on Rikers Island in New York City. And he was afraid that the guards might try to poison him. Sadly, Mr. Vibes writes, Orta's fears were well-founded. While he has been behind bars at Rikers, dozens of other inmates have reported traces of rat poison in their food, a claim that was recently admitted by prison officials. The prison admitted that these pellets were rat poison, but failed to give the inmates medical attention, failed to offer any explanation as to why the prison's food was tainted by rat poison. But Orta says, you know, he's not going to eat this stuff. So they put together a GoFundMe page. It's GoFundMe.com/OF948K. It's titled Standing Up for Ramsey Orta, R-A-M-S-E-Y-O-R-T-A, to try to raise his bail, which was about $18,000, and give him a little walking around money. And their goal is $40,000 total. They're at $24,000 right now, $24,630 as of this moment, donated by a little over 1,000 people in the last 28 days. But is this what happens when you videotape the police? You end up in a hellhole of a jail being fed rat poison? If you're a person of color, as Ramsey Orta is? Apparently. Is the person who shot this videotape in South Carolina, in North Charleston, is that person going to start being stalked by the police? Is this the new, is this, I mean. Meanwhile, Ferguson, good news. Ferguson elected two new black city council members. The city council of the city of Ferguson is starting to become more representative. So. Anyhow, Kenyatta in Laurinburg, North Carolina. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. This is Kenyatta in Redland, California.
I don't know how I got you in North Carolina. It must be your cell phone number or something. But anyhow,
yeah,
what's
I
up?
Think so. Listen, Tom. You know, I don't know. You probably don't recall, but about 6 weeks ago, I talked to you about some comments from you, Rudy Giuliani, about Obama loving America.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've thought about that a lot, that conversation. And I just wanted to say, I wanted to say something specific and something general. And the general is this. And just the last year, let's not go back 400 years. So just the last year, we've talked about a 17-year-old named Jordan Davis. We've talked about that was on the heels of a kid named Trayvon Martin, who's the same age.
Right.
We've talked about this 7 months ago, a black man by the name of Eric Garner was killed in New York. And his murderer suffered no consequences.
Yep.
About 8 months ago, an 18-year-old.
I would say his
murderer
is plural. Pardon my interrupting you. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. 18-year-old named Michael Brown was murdered by police. His murderer was set free. Right about that time, we had a black woman beaten severely by a California highway patrolman right here in California. I mean, he straddled this woman while she was on the ground and beat her with closed fists. Nothing happened to him.
Right.
Within days of that event, an unarmed black man named Nivelle Ford was gunned down here in Los Angeles by police. His murder suffered no consequences. Just a month ago, I watched Marquise Johnson, a 20-year-old at UVA, being beaten unmercifully by police. To date, there's been no action taken against the uniformed thugs that committed that crime. At the same time, I've got a racist chant at some college here, and I believe in one of the Carolinas with this sorority. What I'm trying to get at here, Tom, is that there's a real serious problem in this country.
Right.
And it goes back to blacks being kept in line by the well-maintained militias, which were also known as slave catchers. That's where the lynching there's a pathology of this in this country, and we're all being intellectually dishonest about it. Because here's the bottom line, Tom, and I always take my hat off to you for doing this and talking about the courage that you have to talk about white privilege. But the bottom line is this: until white people stand up and say, no more of this. It's going to continue to happen because I tell people all the time, the word police comes from the word policy. It is the policy of this country, the policy of this country to do this. And that's how they keep the N-words in line. And it goes back 400 years. And however uncomfortable it is the reality, sir. Now, specifically, I'll be real quick. With regard to this recent shooting of this young man, or this 50-year-old man that took place a couple of days ago, what I'd really like to know, think about the number of shots in the back. I mean, there were multiple shots.
Eight shots.
I almost emptied his, in the back. And what I really would like to know, Tom, is what that I would love to have been a fly on the wall or the windshield and heard that conversation. What made that guy take off like that?
Yeah.
I really would like to know that.
Well, apparently he had just been tased, which is pretty bizarre. But who knows? I mean, apparently there's not a dash cam camera on this thing. And you would think that at the very least there would be that. But we do have. But I agree with you, Kenyatta. And that's why I keep coming back to white privilege is I absolutely, you know, you say police interactions with black people and people who white people are going, oh, yeah, you know, must have been one of those gangbangers or something. I mean, you know, there's that automatic response. Yeah. And it's like without understanding how the power structure in this country not only came about, I think most white people have some vague understanding of that, but how it actually exists today, what white privilege is, and not just with the police, not just with the law, but with the entire structure of society. We're not going to fix this problem. Thank you, Kenyatta.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways to attack this. Obviously, we have to do something with our police, but I think that white people in this country need to wake up. Welcome back. Royce, watching Free Speech TV in Crestview, Florida. Hey, Royce, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. The only thing that really bothers me, that upsets me bad, talking about your last caller, the reason the fella took off running is because he had a lot of child support payments. He
right.
Behind on had been locked up or didn't have nothing to do with the case. And what I was upset about is...
Well, wait, hang on just a second, Royce.
You know,
hang on just a second, Royce. That's the newspaper and particularly kind of the white newspaper narrative is that he ran from the police because he might have been going to jail because he had warrants out for non-payment of child support or something like that. That may be the case. That may have nothing to do with it. It might have been that this was a white racist cop who got out of his car and started wailing on a black guy, and when the guy tried to run, he shot him. We don't know.
Right. The only thing that bothered me, in the video I saw, there was more than the policeman that shot him in the back. There was a police officer standing in front of the man whenever the police officer picked up the taser and threw it down. There was another police officer standing there.
I don't believe so.
That police, yes, sir, he's in the video. It showed him walking up, standing at the man's head when he threw the gun down. Watch the whole.
So the second cop arrives before the taser's planted on Walter Scott?
Yes, he was. He was there before the taser was planted, and they showed him throwing the taser down on the ground.
Well, then he's an accessory to murder.
Absolutely. My name is Royce Willingham, and I seen it with my own eyes.
Yeah. You mean you saw the video?
All in with Chris Hayes is what I seen the video on last night.
Yeah, okay. I missed Chris's show last night. And I confess I have not watched the entire video all the way through. I've seen the clips of it, the salient clips. Very interesting, Royce. Thank you for that. Amazing. Sydney in Chicago, watching Free Speech TV, you wanted to comment on the Chicago elections?
Hi, Tom. Yes. Hi. My name is Cindy.
Oh, Cindy.
And when I went to vote yesterday for the runoff elections, in my precinct, I got my ballot, I went into the polling booth, and my ballot was already pre-marked for Rahm Emanuel.
What?
And I took it back. Yeah, I know. That was kind of my response, too. Let me finish my story. You'll have some more shock. When I took it back to the judges and explained to them what had happened, one judge said to me, "This has been happening all day long." The other judge said to him, "We're going to have to find out how to void all these ballots."
Wow.
So I went in and I voted, and I came home and I did learn the what boiling blood really means yesterday. I called Chewy's campaign to let them know this was going on, and they said yes, they'd been hearing it in one other ward, but no report to my ward prior to my calling. I called the press. I called ABC. They came out and did an interview with me. I called Norm Goldman, who put me on the air. I called the rest of the stations, CBS, NBC, WGN. They came out and interviewed me. And each time I called each one of these press outlets, they told me they had been getting these complaints all day long across the entire city.
So, Cindy,
my big question is, what happened to those ballots that
Damn good question. Cindy, I don't know the answer, but it's a good question. Thank you for the call. We'll have to look into this. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. William in Chicago, listening on CPT. Hey, William, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, Kenyatta was right. He laid down the history very well. There's a 400-year-plus tradition in this country of the killing of blacks with impunity by white authority figures, slave owners, cops, what have you. And now with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, writing stand-your-ground laws for all these red states, the privilege of killing blacks, unarmed, innocent, what have you, has been extended to civilians.
Correct.
So what we have in this country is we have a tradition that is almost impossible to overcome. You know, I'm writing a book about the only way to stop this. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that I would talk about on the radio because I fully think that, you know, just like the gentleman got locked up in Rikers for filming what he filmed, there's a good chance that if I write a book like this and it tells that story, you know, I may not last.
Yeah.
So this is not a pleasant place to live. You know, I'm biracial and I've experienced small amounts, you know, not as much as many people who are darker than I am. But it's unconscionable that this happens. And you're absolutely right. Whites have no idea. You know, the dichotomy between the behavior that whites experience with cops and non-whites experience with cops is so otherworldly that it's very hard for what you suggest, which is to get white people to do something about this.
Well, I think we first have to wake them up. I'm sure this is a terribly imperfect analogy, but up until just a decade ago, it was considered okay in polite company to make denigrating jokes about gay people, for example, and for politicians, progressive politicians, people, you know, the Bill Clinton politicians, to say, "Oh, gay marriage? No. Maybe civil unions, but not gay marriage." And you know, again, there was that straight privilege, right? And I think that over the last decade, what has happened is that the gay community has succeeded in large part by coming out in families, and it's easier, I think, for the gay community because the gay community is absolutely, totally, positively multiracial, but the gay community has been able to communicate to their friends and neighbors and coworkers, we're people too, and we'd like some of that straight privilege that you've got, like the ability to get married, the ability to visit somebody in a hospital, the ability to walk down the street and not have somebody throw an egg at you or call you a name. The ability not to be trashed by the police, particularly, you know, a gay person who's in drag or a transgender person or like that. And so we've seen how quickly that has changed as a consequence of normal straight white people waking up. And I think if normal straight white people, and particularly white men, because that's the pinnacle of white privilege, if white men were to wake up to what white privilege is all about, then we would have the basis for the beginning of really substantial change. Because, frankly, the power structure in this country, the economic power structure, the media power structure, the political power structure, are all held by white males. Am I making sense here, William?
Yes, you are. But there's a huge, huge difference between the two analogies. And I understand you said that it may not stand up. By and large, demographically, the LGBTQ community is far wealthier than the average black community member.
Well, in large part, that's because they're presumably the same percentage of whites as they are of blacks. And whites are far wealthier than the blacks.
You're right about the demographics, but you cannot discount the power of the economics.
Yeah.
You know, when a business discriminates against someone in the LGBTQ community, they reap an immediate whirlwind of financial woe.
Well, in a way, I mean, this woman who came out, this baker that Fox News has been featuring, they've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for her
Yeah, but look, bigotry also sells, and
right.
There's a huge backlash. I mean, all of these religious freedom laws are basically the backlash against the fact that the times where you can successfully, without impunity, express your bigotry against gay people is pretty much over.
I don't think it's pretty much over. It's on its way out. But it's the same, and I would say the same thing with like rape culture on campus and things like that. I mean, as by and large, the white male power structure of this country starts understanding about their privilege relative to women and to gay people, that understanding needs to be extended to people of color. That's that white privilege. And the fact that Bill O'Reilly is still denying
right.
it exists blows my mind.
You're absolutely right. But the problem is the white male entitled power structure does not respect anything other than, the loss of a financial largesse. Okay. All the things that you're talking about, all of the changes that you're talking about come about through economics. Okay. They come about through economics.
Money is power, in other words.
Absolutely. And you know, the Supreme Court gave, the moneyed elite the ultimate power to run this country. So when you talk, I understand what you're saying. But when we talk about racial matters, if in fact something was going to change, it would have changed somehow in the last 400 plus years. And it hasn't. As a matter of fact, things have gotten worse. And
well, no, there have been substantial changes in 400 years. Come on, we fought a civil war over this.
No, I understand that. But what I'm talking about is just merely the societal things. Let's take the time pre-Barack Obama till now. The increase in racial incidents, the increase in racial problems, the increase in murder of black people has increased.
Oh, sure. Obama being elected president stirred up the white racists. Absolutely.
It scared them. It scared them. It didn't stir them up. It scared them. It scared ignorant ones into believing that their white privilege was eroding.
Excellent point. And I would say if you go back to like the Bakke case, you know, the white guy who sued the University of Michigan at the Supreme Court for not getting into medical school because of affirmative action, that again, that's that fear of loss of white privilege. And you know, it's rearing its ugly head. William, thank you for the call. Very thought-provoking. We'll continue this conversation throughout the day. Up next, libertarianism.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Mark Ames. I want to continue with this conversation that we've been having about the murder of Walter Scott in South Carolina and white privilege and all the dimensions of this. And one piece of it has to do with, frankly, Rand Paul, who just announced his candidacy for president of the United States yesterday. In 1982, he wrote an editorial for the Baylor University College paper, Rand Paul. He said, every piece of anti-discrimination legislation passed over the past few decades ignores one of the basic inalienable rights of man, the right to discriminate. He later wrote, this was in 2002, decisions concerning private property and association should in a free society be unhindered some of these associations will discriminate. A free society will abide unofficial private discrimination, even when that means allowing hate-filled groups to exclude people based on the color of their skin. End of quote. This is supposed to be libertarianism. What the hell is libertarianism? Mark Ames, senior editor of Pando Daily, author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine and Beyond, is on the line with us. Pando.com, of course, the website. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me on again.
Thanks for joining us. You wrote a piece for Alternet back in 2013 titled The True History of Libertarianism in America, a Phony Ideology to Promote a Corporate Agenda. Tell us the story. Where did this libertarian thing come from?
Yeah, so, I mean, I find it interesting that, first of all, that people, on the one hand, will say libertarianism is something that's so fresh and new, and it's the big alternative to the two-party stranglehold and so on, without even actually asking or answering, well, where does libertarianism come from? When did it start? Who launched it? Has it always been there? And libertarians themselves have answers for this. If you read their books, it's not particularly fun reading, but I've done a lot of research on this over the years. And they'll all tell you that the modern libertarian movement, and the first people to sort of use that term for this ideology was launched in 1946, 47. It was a foundation called, the Foundation for Economic Education. It's a think tank or whatever you call it, when, you know, essentially like a 501c3. And it turns out, and the head of it is this guy, Leonard Reed, and he's considered by libertarians sort of the first guru of libertarianism. Well, this is a guy who was a Chamber of Commerce executive, National Association of Manufacturers. He's just a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even write his own books, right? And so he sets up this outfit called the FEE right after the war, backed by all the big names in corporate America, the big three auto manufacturers, the big oil companies, banks, the big steel manufacturers, DuPont, Monsanto. And the job of libertarianism in those years early on was to provide essentially quasi-intellectual propaganda to back big businesses' push against the New Deal. And so the ideology was basically founded to push back against the New Deal and against social democracy. And these people are hardcore reactionaries, just like Charles Koch. You know, these are real hardcore reactionaries who wanted to take the country back to the days of Harding and Coolidge, with all that implies.
Well, and I was just thinking of Warren Harding. I mean, when he was elected in the election of 1920 on a campaign platform of less government, less business in government, more business, more government, less government in business, more business in government. In other words, deregulate and privatize. And on the campaign platform of dropping the top tax rate on billionaires or rich people back then from 91% down to 25%, both of which he did in 1921 when he became president. What was that called back then? They didn't call it libertarianism. Was that just, hey,
Americanism.
It was called what?
Americanism. Also, anti-labor. This is a huge part of it, too. I mean, it's an anti-labor, anti-social democracy, anti-socialist philosophy and pro-big business. It was essentially called Americanism.
Interesting.
America first, isolationism. Very violently anti-union, stoking ethnic, and race division, to advance the agenda. I mean, Harding, there were reports that he was inducted into the KKK in the White House.
Wow.
And I'll remind you that Charles Koch, in one of his newsletters right around the time that Obama was elected, I wrote about this for The Nation. Charles Koch did a column in his Koch Industries newspaper and said, you know, people ask me, who do I think is the best president of the 20th century and the worst? And he said, my answer will probably surprise you. Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge were the best presidents that promoted liberty more than anyone. And that's, you know, so the libertarianism, there's the propaganda PR version of what libertarianism means, and because originally they stole that word from the left. Originally, libertarianism had to do with kind of social anarchism from Europe. They kind of stole that word because it had liberty in its root.
So hang on just a second. There's echoes here of other events. I remember in the mid-1970s, in the late 60s and the early 70s, I had been friendly with folks in and supportive of the Right to Life movement. Because the Right to Life movement in the late 60s and early 70s was the anti-death penalty movement. They called themselves the Right to Life movement. And after Roe v. Wade, the anti-abortion people took that term. And, you know, for a couple of years, there were a lot of anti-death penalty people really upset, but they lost the argument. Are you saying that the word libertarian similarly had a completely different meaning and was in use by?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was known as a left-wing socialist. As a part of socialism, essentially European socialism.
Wow.
Chomsky's, you can find this online. Chomsky himself has talked about this. As he said, you know, everywhere else in the world, the term libertarianism is connected to socialism, anarchism from the late 19th century in Europe. And as he said, American libertarianism is essentially from Mars. It's the complete opposite.
Well, it's not from Mars. It's from a lobbyist in 1946.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where it comes from. And I do think it's important to understand the origins of libertarianism, because people seem to keep getting blindsided by what they think are contradictions. For example, you know, you were just talking about Rand Paul, who is actually stating a very basic libertarian belief, which is that people should be able to do whatever they want on their property. That's what they mean by liberty and libertarianism.
Right.
And that means the right to discriminate against anybody of any race, because
right.
property is inviolate. It's people who have property should be able to do whatever they want with it. And the more property they have, the more power they should have.
Well, and the Supreme Court took this position for well over 100 years, that the right to associate in the First Amendment had a parallel right, which is the right not to associate, which was the right to discriminate. I mean, they used this to support white-only country clubs and all
yeah.
kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, this is the basis of Plessy v. Ferguson, was it not?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And on top of it, the idea, he's got a completely false sense of history, though, because on the other hand, the term discrimination also has to do with, you know, with monopoly power, you know, and the populists fought against the discrimination, which was the way that private companies were discriminating against certain farmers in certain regions and so on in order to basically extract profits. And this is deemed illegal by by government, and they've been fighting against price discrimination. So I mean, like, the idea that there's one definition of discrimination and it's in the old through history, it's just absurd. And so I think, you know, to really understand libertarianism, it's essentially it's a politics and a philosophy for oligarchs, for the super rich. In which property is liberty.
Right, and that reinforces and holds together the essentially white business power structure in this country.
Yes.
Yeah. Mark Ames, you are brilliant. Senior editor of Pando Daily, pando.com, author of Going Postal. Thank you, Marge. Mark?
Thanks again.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mark is one of the best writers around, and his piece from a couple of years ago, The True History of Libertarianism in America, over at Alternet, is brilliant. Check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I've been studying libertarianism for a couple of years, well, maybe 3 years now. I subscribe to Reason Magazine. I joined the Cato Institute. I've been studying those people. And one of the things about libertarianism is you should be free to do whatever you want on your own property. But the other part of it that they never mention is as long as it doesn't harm other people.
Well, and they define harm as the application of force. Of course,
now,
I guess you could say, you know, throwing somebody out because of the wrong skin color is the application of force.
If you burn coal and you melt the ice cap, you're harming me. I need that ice cap to keep my weather constant.
Right. Right.
Libertarians do lots of things that harm other people, but they always ignore that second part of it.
Right. Excellent point. Excellent
Bring
point.
Bring that up to them when you argue with them on TV, and you will shut them down every time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Thank you very much for the call, Ed. That's a good one. Carol in Merle's Inlet, South Carolina. Hey, Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, I'm calling about the murder of Mr. Scott by the police officer here. It's all over the news. There's a press conference going on right now, which unfortunately for the mayor of North Charleston, he allowed some of the public in, and they're yelling questions about, is it a typical police procedure to handcuff a man that's been gunned down? Then he ignores them and goes on to another question from a press person. But it's a very hot and heavy press conference going on right now. What my question about all this is, okay, the police officer stopped the man in his car, right? So it has a license plate on. He either ran the plate or he didn't. But you can issue a proper warrant for arrest of a person at their home. You don't shoot them if they decide to run. The family was asked in a press conference yesterday why the man ran, as though it's illegal to run, which it's not, of course. But he ran because they assumed that he ran because he has owed child support in the past. Now, that's not grounds for gunning somebody down any more than a broken taillight.
Right.
The man, Mr. Scott, ran. His fight or flight kicked in, that tendency that every human being has. And he, if you're black, unfortunately, it's lose-lose. If you fight, it's a lose situation for you. If a bad officer like that running, bad mistake, too. I wanted to also mention that there was indeed a second person that showed up on the scene who was I don't know if it's called by the officer or what, but there was another person who was a medic. So it was a police medic. And from the video, it doesn't look like he tried to do anything to help ascertain or revive Mr. Scott. When I saw the video, it looked like the police officer that had gunned Mr. Scott down put his fingers to Mr. Scott's neck to see if there was a pulse.
Right.
But he was definitely handcuffed after he was...
One of the bullets penetrated his heart, so he was almost certainly dead within a minute or so of the time that he was shot.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. It's an embarrassing moment to live in South Carolina, that's for sure.
I can imagine. Carol, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching us there in South Carolina on Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. We're talking about this whole, there's kind of a convergence happening here in American politics of a bunch of different things. A Libertarian Party that was invented in 1946 as a lobbying front group for American industry to give a political and intellectual rationale for policies that make rich people richer and diminish the power of labor. That's the story of the Libertarian Party. And, of course, the former Charles Koch Foundation, now known as the Cato Institute, Reason Magazine, funded I don't know if today what they're funded by, but historically funded by the Koch brothers. And they being, two guys who inherited a very wealthy fossil fuel company from dad. And now they're all about, hey, it's the work your way up and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and on it goes. But the death of Walter Scott in South Carolina. I'm wondering if this might be a tipping point. There was a time, I've seen these tipping points in my lifetime. And usually you can only recognize them in retrospect. You look back 10 years and go, oh, yeah. But the rights of women during my lifetime have changed considerably. I mean, I remember, running a business in 1973 and needing to hire, we actually needed to hire a secretary for our business for the Woodley Herber Company. We needed somebody who could answer the phones, who could do letters, who could do some of the bookkeeping, some fairly simple stuff. And so I went to the newspaper looking for such a person, and here's the help wanted ads. Help, you know, wanted men, wanted women. And we ended up actually hiring a man for that job. It was a guy who was a part-time student at Michigan State, and he did a great job. In fact, he ended up vice president of the company. But in my lifetime, I have seen that tipping point from the kind of Mad Men world, the relationship between men and women, to today. I've seen the change from where it's acceptable to make jokes about gay people or even to joke about somebody by implying that they're gay, that kind of thing, being, quote, funny 10, 20, 30 years ago to being considered offensive now. And both of these were realizations by the largely white, largely male power structure of this country and the largely white, largely male media structure of this country. And you would think after, you know, after the Emancipation Proclamation and the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then Rutherford Hayes stopping and undoing Reconstruction in the 1870s, but you would think through all of this, and then the, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson, and then Brown v. Board reversing Plessy, and I mean, all of this stuff after all of these post Dred Scott events, that we would be farther along down the road now that we've recognized straight privilege and male privilege to recognizing white privilege. So anyway, my thoughts on it, your thoughts on it. Anne in Sugar Grove, North Carolina. Hey, Anne, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Great to be on the air with you.
Thank you.
I'm 60 years old, just a couple of weeks ago, and I remember working in the 70s as a legal secretary, and you had to get the coffee. I had to go pick up their wives, you know, specially made curtains, and this is way before gym shoes. So we were wearing, you know, high heels and nylons. And
yep.
If you said no, we got fired.
Yeah.
What I really called, though, is about the white privilege thing.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Watauga County, and our representative here is Virginia Fox. Her grandson last May got in trouble, got arrested on high school property with another student for dealing in Schedule II drugs, which is like Oxycontin, those sort of things. That was in May of 2014. By the end of June, middle of June, he was gone through the court system, got probation and community service.
Right.
And boy, oh boy, is that white privilege. I don't know what happened to the other kid that was arrested with him. She's basically had enough power to like erase it off the internet. You can hardly find anything about it anymore. And then my other example is down here in Charlotte, General Petraeus. You know, he lies to the FBI, tells secrets to his mistress, you know, has an affair on his wife, and he's able to also plead to a misdemeanor.
Right.
And is looking at probation, maybe not even probation, who knows. But just my two examples of white privilege here in North Carolina.
Yeah, and they're good ones. And
mind-boggling.
Yeah, and then and you mentioned Martha Stewart when you were talking to Laurie and our call screener.
Right, right. Martha got jail time for lying to the FBI.
Right, right. And I wonder to what extent that was because she was female versus the fact that she was a fairly high profile Democrat, and that was during the Bush administration, wasn't it, or was that during the tail end of the Clinton administration?
No, that was in Bush because. I worked for one of the major U.S. attorney's offices from 1985 to 2007,
mm-hmm.
and I distinctly remember it happening during the Bush, his second term. I think it was his second term in office. But,
right.
Yeah, I mean, the white privilege thing. And then, you know, going back to even like, you know, Social Security didn't apply to domestics and farmers. When I talk to people in this area here, they're like, what's domestics?
Right.
They don't even know that they're house cleaners.
Oh, my.
Housewives. I'm like, oh, or not housewives, but, you know, work for the housewife. I'm like, have you seen the movie The Help?
Yeah, there you go, which is actually a very good movie. And thank you for the call. Thank you very much. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Have you experienced, or what are your experiences of white privilege? How do we fix this situation, in your opinion? Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Back to 1964, Rand Paul's eccentric bargain with the GOP. He's saying, yeah, you know, we'll if I become president, I'll stop spying on you. I'll, you know, fix the Fed or something, and we won't have any more wars or something like that. But let's, like, do away with that whole Civil Rights Act stuff. I mean, that's government interference and private right of association. And this is what Rand Paul has been basically saying and writing about his whole entire life. And it's not just uniquely Rand Paul. He said decisions. This is in 2002. Rand Paul wrote a letter to his local newspaper in Bowling Green, Kentucky. He said decisions concerning private property and association should, in a free society, be unhindered. He added that these decisions should remain unhindered, even though some associations will discriminate. Ian Millhiser, writing about this over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, he wrote, Rand Paul wrote, a free society will abide unofficial private discrimination, even when that means allowing hate-filled groups to exclude people based on the color of their skin. Look up white privilege in the dictionary, and there's a picture of Rand Paul. Would this guy even be in the Senate if his dad hadn't been in the House? I don't think so. I think he'd be Mr. Aqua Buddha. I mean, for that matter, what happened to that woman that he and his buddy tied up and dragged down to the river and made smoke Aqua Buddha? I'm not sure we ever heard the story about how consensual or non-consensual that was, or, you know. It's probably not. This is not anything for a campaign. It's just in my mind, it's another indication. And I just have to say, I'm continually, you know, I just a couple of days ago over at Union Station, grabbing lunch at I shouldn't name the restaurant, but at one of the kind of healthy fast food joints in Union Station, which is what I usually do after I get off the air. I grab my lunch there and go over and put together the TV show for the evening. And an African-American clerk said, do you want your receipt, sir? And I said, no, thanks. He says, are you sure? I'm like, no, I don't need the receipt. Okay. Terrell in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Terrell. Thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
I mean, this whole thing about white privilege and the police structure, it has been nurtured by our political system, by the media, for as long as this has been a country.
Yep.
If you want to really pay attention to how borderline racist something is, listen to the radio, AM radio, or a small town newscast when they talk about any person of color in a small community.
How so?
That's the stuff we need to stop.
How so?
I mean, because
what would I hear, for example?
I mean, you would hear, for example, far more incendiary language when it comes to anything, big, scary person, all that. I mean, it's almost like comparing the Michael Brown thing to the guy who crashed the airplane deliberately in the Alps.
Right.
Nobody was calling that guy a thug. Nobody went into that guy's criminal history. Nothing. Nobody. And it's quite obvious which one is far worse. And that's just an example of the privilege on each side of the spectrum. When it's a white guy, it's the same thing goes with terrorism or anything else. If it's a white guy, it's a totally different how it's covered. When it's a person of color, then here we go.
Yeah.
And you have to stop this at the federal level. Now, I was a military police officer, and you never seen this on base. Now, when people first came in, you know, they would exclusively try to patrol black barbecues, you know, certain people from the South, and then we would have to pull them aside and be like, you can't do that on this base. That's a captive.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And it does happen, and it's part of our society. And what you have to do is you have to harshly punish people for doing it up front, because they're going to lie to your face.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have people immediately co-sign it, no matter how wrong they are.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what the Fox News business model is keeping that going.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter whether it's true or not.
Yeah.
But it has to be done on a federal level, because I don't trust our criminal justice system to take care of these people, because they're part of the system. And if you take any cog out of this wheel, our whole criminal justice system falls apart. And we have to do something. And, I mean, it has to be a national board. They have to have no rights, no lawyers, no nothing. When I was in the military, if you got in trouble, you got max time. It didn't matter what it was. Because why? You should know better. And, you know, with us in our country, we're just like, no, let the nice police officer go, because he keeps the black people in line. He gets to murder black people however they want to. That's what this sycophantic worshiping police come from. It's no other thing other than that. That's all it is, man, and it's so sick. And I tell you right now, you show that video, it's just that what white people see when things are obviously not going their way, the things that come out of their mouth, that's the problem.
Yeah, yeah, and those things are coming out of their mouth because they're clueless. And,
yeah. I mean,
that's the most charitable explanation I could come up with.
I mean, you can open up the phone lines. You can have people who disagree with you, and it would amaze you the stuff that comes out of their mouth.
Yeah.
Actually, don't even look at that. Look at the comment threads on these stories.
Oh, yeah. You should read my email. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Or the comments over, you know, and we actually do a fairly good job of keeping our message boards over at TomHartmann.com. clean, but it's just, you know, like you say, in any story anywhere about this stuff, this is what you're going to find out. Terrell, thank you very much for the call. Excellent point. Bruce in Katona, New York. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Firstly, I have three things I want to unpack on this, because I've had these conversations many times in my life. But one is just a quick thank you. I actually ran for local office and didn't win, but it was partly inspired by the old notion of tag, you're it.
Good on you, Bruce.
I really do appreciate it. I ran for town board.
Great.
But at any rate, I don't want to spend time on that. Three things to unpack. Number one, I mean, I was born and raised and grew up in New Rochelle, in the New Rochelle public schools here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And very mixed population. Won't go into all the details. My school was 50-50 black, white. And so I have a very different perspective than a lot of my friends and peers from other communities now that I live in northern Westchester. But the first thing, number one, first member of my graduating class to die, Emery Robinson, shot in the back by a New Rochelle rookie police officer at age 19, you know, running away from the officer.
And he was black?
Things have not changed. So that's the first thing, because that's part of my view. But here's, you know, how we discuss, or how I discuss some of this. A good friend of mine, when I worked for a large public company, we had a conference in Ocean City, Maryland. This guy, Gary, who's black and was a coworker, you know, equal rank with me, and we're good friends, and could train to come up through the ranks. We were spent the night, you know, the nights we were there, we roomed together, and we would just sit and talk, you know, about race and race relations. He made some points to me that I've never thought of that it helped me to start to think about what it's like to be black in America as a white man. One, he said, is, you know, here we're in Ocean City. Let's just say you were here and we were here with our families and you wanted to go to eat. And I said, yeah, down the street, you know, by the boardwalk, there's a really nice Italian restaurant and really primo great food. And you walk into the restaurant and every single person is black. The patrons, the workers, et cetera, are all black. He said, I have two questions for you. One, would you notice? And two, would you stay? And it really rocked me. And he said, that's the world I live in every day. You walk into a grocery store or a business, and everyone or the majority is white, and that's just normal. There's nothing unusual here. I walk in, and I see the eyes follow me, the people looking at me, the workers following me around, just because I stand out, and I see that, and I live in that every day. And you can never, and I'll say he's right, never experience as a white person walking into a business, the only thing I've come somewhat close is while running for office last year, I spoke at the local Baptist church, and there the population is probably, whatever, 60-70% minority. But that's probably the closest I've come. And so that's how I start, because I don't think most white people have ever thought about the fact that when you go into a business or store and everyone's white, that's a unique experience.
Remember back 4 or 5 years ago, Bill O'Reilly walked into a black, an upscale black restaurant in Harlem? Pardon?
Yeah, with Al Sharpton. And, oh, they weren't saying, yo, ho, oh, give me, you know, slap me, so whatever. I mean, the stuff that came out, but that's the point, too.
Right.
The stuff that came out of his mouth, which was meant to try and make it seem to, like he's just, oh, a normal guy, he was so clearly, overtly internalized racist.
Yeah.
And the third thing I want to unpack is the only time I used to own a Toyota Supra back in the 80s, you know, and I was young. And the only time that I wasn't speeding and pulled over, I was driving with a friend of mine, Dial, black man, and we were driving down the street in New Rochelle, and a police officer went the opposite direction, turned around, lights on, sirens, pull us over. It's the only time I wasn't speeding, because I did speed, that I get pulled over, that I was just driving in my car. And the officer said, can I see your license and registration? And I leaned forward and I said, officer, this is my car. And his tone changed. He goes, oh, okay, it's your car. Can you, do you have the license and registration? And I said, sure. Here's, and I got my license, my registration, showed it to him. He's like, didn't even ask for Dial's ID. Once you saw that, and basically I vouched for the fact that he didn't just
right.
Steal his car.
Another white privilege story.
There you go.
Bruce, I got to run, but thank you for the call. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls after this. It's 15 minutes before the end. Welcome back. George in Pasadena, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, George, what's up?
I've been watching these events happen, and it's just bothering me. I'm going crazy. And I try to believe in Martin Luther King, but I really believe in Malcolm X. And this just goes to show you that Martin Luther King was wrong. He had no idea how vicious the white race is and how stuck on hurting us, using us, and hurting us is in white society. And
how can you say that, George? He was treated horribly throughout his life, and he was assassinated by a white guy.
Yes, but he believed in Jesus. He believed in God, and God's not getting us through. We're dying. I was going down.
Malcolm X believed in Allah. I mean, it's merciful what? God. Pardon my interrupting. Go ahead, George.
But I was going down the street the other day, my son and I driving, and the police. Well, there was a lot of people on the street. Police saw me driving, and they stopped. They went behind me, and they went on around. And I was afraid. I wasn't afraid for myself. I was afraid for my son. And that's all we have is fear when we see the police. And people can't live with fear, afraid to come out of their houses. And
so
the society is really messed up.
So what was the solution to this problem that Malcolm X offered that you think was superior to nonviolent confrontation of racism, which was Martin Luther King's solution?
I don't think nonviolence is going to get it. I think something this has to happen, or we have to find a way out of America. The black people that want to stay in America, stay. That's just off the top of my head. I really don't know. But I know that we live in fear.
The African Americans live in fear. Clearly. Do you recall when Huey Newton showed up at the California State House with a rifle?
Yes.
I mean, that was what, 67, I think, 66, whatever the year was. And what happened immediately thereafter was Governor Reagan pushed through gun control legislation. Oh, my God, black people have weapons?
Yes.
If the kind of popularized, at least in white culture, vision of Malcolm X, which was we will shoot back, And I frankly think it was, you know, everything Malcolm X said, and I'm no scholar of his work, but I am pretty familiar with it. I think everything he said was far more nuanced than that. But if it came down to that, I would say that that would be the same mistake that I hear from these white guys who call in who say, oh, society's all going to fall apart and I've got to get, you know, 3 assault weapons and a year's worth of food in my basement. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, that's not how you win. We tried that. It was called the Civil War. It was a disaster.
Well, look what ISIS is doing. ISIS is changing countries.
Not for the long haul. I mean, you could say the same thing about Hitler. He had some really substantial victories. But, you know, even if he had won Europe, I don't think he could have held it for more than a generation. I think things change from within, and they change organically. And, yeah, you might have violent revolutions. Certainly we did. It birthed our country. But we were on a separate continent from Europe. So it's really a slightly different story than an internal revolution. I mean, that was the Civil War. And that didn't work out so well. But it's an interesting one. George, thank you for sharing your perspective with me. I appreciate it. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by thankless.com/watch. Who are you thankful for? To see an example, you can go to thankless.com/watch and watch the story, see and hear the story of Sholene and Kir, the slave from South Sudan. Bob Ney is on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Bob Ney, the author also of Sideswiped, about his years in the U.S. House of Representatives and before and after, actually, and how Congress really works. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. So, Congressman, what's going on in the world today?
Well, I was listening about the conversation, of course, of the now policeman charged with murder. And the real story that we're looking at now, and this will be further dissected, I guarantee, by the media, is the fact of the statements of the police department, which are outrageously different than the video. I mean, the police department within hours was talking about how the deceased had attacked the officer directly, had taken the taser, there was a confrontation. I mean, it's a completely different story that was put out. And again, I'm sure it will be dissected quite a lot. What we haven't really seen, though, Tom, are statements coming out of the Hill, at least at this point in time, in the sense of taking a bigger picture look at the other issues. I mean, the militarization of the police, the rapid weapon fire, statements that police departments make, and if they aren't accurate, why is nobody taken to task? I mean, a completely broad picture that I think some people are thinking about that are involved with the solution side of government, but at this point in time, we haven't seen much on it.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is just going to be one tragic, isolated story. I think that probably will grow, especially in light of what the police department said about all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly look like either liars, fools, or both. It almost seems to me, Bob, and I don't know, I'm talking with my listeners and viewers about this, that we may be at another tipping point. We've had in my lifetime the tipping point of, you know, women in the workplace and in other venues as well, you know, basically gender rights. We've had now, over the last decade and a half or so, a really, really rapid tipping point has been reached and I think surpassed with regard to gay rights. And I think that we're approaching a tipping point where white people begin to understand white privilege. And perhaps it's because so many of them have lost it. I mean, you know, having lost their homes and, you know, the 35 years of Reaganomics and everything else. But understanding white privilege and joining with our brothers and sisters of color to say enough of this institutional racism, essentially.
Yes, I think it is going to be, as you say, a tipping point because people are starting to realize that there has been a lot going on for quite a period of time.
Right.
And now these high-profile cases, that show exactly what's been going on, such as the discrepancy here, and I can't state enough. The police report has nothing in reality with the video, so they just carte blanche lied. I mean, we can't even say that it's their point of view in the sense of what, if you look at the statement they made. But if you also look at the equipment the police departments have, if you look at the fact of some things that haven't hit the news, there was two people that were shot in a hallway who had called the police. They were attacked by a knife, and they were ended up being killed by the police when they arrived. Now, we all know there are police out there to serve, but the answers to these problems in order to clean things up and straighten things up and have the rights protected has always been, well, you know, they're really out there serving. I don't think a lot of people are disputing the fact that police put their lives on the line, but I think people have started to wake up to that tipping point of the fact that there's something seriously wrong.
Yeah, yeah. One of my callers, I've not watched the entire video, I confess. I should have this morning. I've seen what I thought were the important pieces, and, you know, they get played on TV a lot and whatnot. But somebody called this morning and said that at the time that Officer What's-His-Name was planting the gun, Michael Slager. At the time Officer Slager was planting the taser on Walter Scott, on Walter Scott's dead body, that a second police officer could be seen in the video shot. Is that true?
Yes, that's correct. There is a second police officer. The police officer appeared to me, I think, was African-American. Michael Slager, the first officer, was white. It appears to me, again, it's a long shot of that video, but yes, that's true. There is a second officer. Then, you know, he's the victim is handcuffed. The second officer is putting, I think she's female. And I watched the video several times. It's just, it's a view, you have to see it, that was hard to determine. Was putting on gloves. The other thing is nobody picked this man up. Nobody turned him over. Nobody, until then, all of a sudden, the second officer then bends down and the video stops. But that is true. Within a short period of time, there is a second police officer there.
Why is she not being held to account? I mean, if she saw evidence being planted on a dead man, isn't that something that should have been said?
Well, yes, and that's the problem with all of this. You know, and
it's the blue wall of silence?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Is this the blue wall of silence, the thin blue line stuff?
Right, and that's the problem. And, you know, the release came out of the department, and so the question is, will the public rely upon, you know, the forces to be, meaning the government, the prosecutor, to take the appropriate action? What about the second person? What about the people in the department that carte blanche, whoever the supervisor was, the press person, that carte blanche put out something that was completely a lie? Are they going to be held accountable? So right now it's one officer, and that's it's a tragedy in itself, and he needs held accountable. But what about the bigger picture of the follow-up? Let's face it, if that person, whoever took that video, was not there, you and I wouldn't be having this same conversation today.
Right, and with, you know, over 1,000 police shootings, killings a year in the United States. We kill more people in a year than the United Kingdom has since 1900. There's probably a lot of this kind of thing going on that we don't know about. Congressman Bob Ney, thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Alex McFarlane is on the line with us. He's the director of Christian Worldview and Apologetics at the Christian Worldview Center, North Greenville University, Greenville, South Carolina. A talk show host to the program Exploring the Word radio program. Alex McFarlane, mcfarland, farland.com is his website. Alex, welcome back to the program.
And plus, you can add to my bio, plus a big fan of the Tom Hartman Show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You wrote a piece titled Fights Over RFRAs, These Religious Freedom Restoration Acts Show Rejection of Moral Boundaries. And if I can quote from it, you say, the United States is based on a belief that there are some moral boundaries. The pilgrims came to the New World because moral justice cried for realization through religious freedom. Those pilgrims who came to the United States believed that if women were witches, they should be thrown in ponds. If they drowned, that meant that they were actually not possessed by the devil. If they didn't drown, they were possessed by the devil, and they got hanged. Don't our standards change over time?
Christians ended the Salem witch trials thanks to Cotton Mather and Increase Mather, two Christians. The insanity of the Salem witch trials were put to an end. What I want to talk about, though, are the fact that America was based on belief in moral absolutes, moral truth. Our Constitution, the Declaration, all hung on there being some moral boundaries, and the advancement of the gay agenda hangs on there not being any moral boundaries.
No, it's not true. By the way, the moral boundary that was built into the Constitution, Alex, was that black people were not fully human, that they were property, not people.
That's not in our U.S. Constitution.
It was in the Constitution at the founding of this republic, and for the first
time. Helped rectify that as quickly as they did. Look, Charles Carroll,
80 years?
Declaration of Independence, said that any person who fights belief in God and morality really undermines our freedom. In 1800, Fisher Ames, who wrote the First Amendment, wrote a biography about George Washington, the sublime life and thought of George Washington. Fisher Ames, who wrote the First Amendment, said that this nation cannot exist without morals and religion. Now, here's what I say. I spoke last night at UNC Chapel Hill, and I say this. For those that want to engage in homosexual activity, knock yourself out. Have at it. But don't tear down the culture, the milieu, the context that gives you the freedom to safely walk around as a non-heterosexual.
How does it possibly harm you, unless you're a conflicted bisexual or gay person, how does it possibly harm you that the couple next door is gay?
It doesn't at all. Why do you want to discriminate against them? What we're looking at on the gay agenda is an enforced tolerance whereby not only do I tolerate, but I have to embrace and affirm. And that is something that can only come at the cost of the religious freedom of those that disagree with.
This sounds to me like the argument you're making is conflating business and religion. Are you suggesting that if I own a business, that I should be able to say my religion, as the Mormon Church officially set up until the 1970s or 80s, my religion says that black people are descended from Cain, not Abel, and therefore my business will not serve them. This was a popular argument made in the 1960s in the South in the United States, and for 400 years, by the way, before that, that I should be able to discriminate like that? Is that what you're arguing?
Homosexuality is a behavior. It is not an ethnicity.
Is religion not a behavior?
Religious freedom is one of the core values that our founding fathers built America on. Restaurants everywhere. McDonald's,
how is the freedom? As is the freedom of association.
To anyone. Look, we must not in America, just because there's been a well-funded, well-organized, unrelenting 40-year marketing campaign to legitimize homosexuality as being normative or equal commensurate with heterosexuality, we cannot turn over 6,000 years of human
bigotry,
history, marriage, 2,000 years of Western civilization.
Alex, you're wrong.
A 40-year
agenda. Alex, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're absolutely wrong. If you're talking about going back to biblical standards of marriage, that means that if a man rapes a woman, she's his wife. It's in the Bible.
Tom, you're missing the point.
It means that if Solomon wants 700 wives, he gets them. It's in the Bible.
Now, think about this. Imagine if all couples were a man and a woman and built a stable, loving home life. The world would be a pretty good place. Imagine if all couples were...
Not if there were gay people who were in pain and agony as a consequence of it.
Exist. Look, our nation, our founding fathers from Jefferson, Franklin, Carroll, on down, they believed in a Judeo-Christian moral code. That's why...
Thomas Jefferson cut all the miracles out of the Bible.
Moses holding the Decalogue. This agenda, and I'm not saying that people behind closed doors can't engage in what they would choose to engage in. I happen to know with at the master's level, a degree in developmental psychology, that there are certain things that contribute to same-sex attraction, and homosexuality is a means of dealing with emotional pain.
That's nonsense. That's pseudoscience.
Well, I beg to disagree.
Again, with the exception of a very small slice of people who are bisexual.
There's no science that says people are born gay, and we're endangering our constitution based on a behavior, not an ethnicity.
No, there's a very simple question here, and I'm not going to confront you with it because I don't want to personalize this, but you know, at what age did you notice the other sex? At what age? And what was your interest? And if you ask gay people, they will tell you, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I started noticing people the same sex were interesting to me. Straight people will tell you the same thing. I mean, this is clearly, it goes way beyond anything. This hocus pocus, Marcus Bachmann nonsense psychology stuff. And beyond that, again, I get back to the point, religion is a choice. If you're choosing your religion, why do I have to have your religion inflicted on me in the marketplace? The marketplace is not religious.
Tom, listen, this is not about religion. This is about the philosophical and epistemological underpinnings of our Constitution, which is belief that there are some moral absolutes.
You want to go back to slavery.
Morality and religion are two different things, Tom.
So you want to go back to slavery.
Nobody can force religion on anybody.
So you want to go back to slavery.
No, of course not. That's
it was
insane.
In our Constitution. It's what our founders all supported.
Having spoken at more than 150 universities, when I present the contributing factors that cause people to experience same-sex attraction, it never fails. And even last night at Chapel Hill, we talked to young people. They come up and they'll say, I've had same-sex attraction. I was molested as a child. My parents abused me. My parents separated.
Alex, the percentage of people who have been molested or abused is huge. And there's no causal relationship, or not a clear causal relationship between those two. And beyond that, as I was saying before, I'm going in circles here. You're arguing that a store should be able to discriminate against. You know, I don't have a problem if your church wants to discriminate. Right.
Think about this for a second. Should a homosexual man who is a printer be forced to print flyers that say, like the Westboro Baptist Church so wrongly would say, God hates fags?
If that's his business.
Pardon?
If that's his business. The rules of business are, if you offer a service to the public, you offer a service to the public. If you're going to start discriminating on which part of the public you're going to offer that service to, you have no right to a business license.
But why should we give a special set of rights to a
It's not a special set of rights. It is the obligation of business to conduct business.
It's on a behavior.
Is a behavior.
The undermining of the rights of Christians. The undermining
the right
of the
to discriminate,
even moral absolutes.
You're saying the discrimination is a right in the United States?
No, but religion, freedom of conscience, is absolutely a constitutionally protected right.
Fine, don't let gay people into your church if you don't want to. I think that would be anti-Christian.
All sinners need Jesus. I'm a saved sinner. All sinners. The Bible says
respectfully, Alex, I don't think that Jesus is with you on this, and I think you might be in big trouble. But I'm sorry, I take it back. I didn't want to personalize this. Dr. Alex McFarland.
So non-judgmental.
Thank you. AlexMcFarland.com. We'll be back. Thank you, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Derek, watching Free Speech TV in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Derek, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was going to talk about that white privilege. Can you hear me?
I can, just fine. Can you hear me?
All right, good. Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Great.
I want to talk about that white privilege.
I remember
a quote I got off that was attributed to Lyndon Baines Johnson. I got it off of Twitter. It was talking about if you convince some broke
LBJ never
guy,
said that, Derek.
All right, who said it? But it seems like
it was promoted, to the best of my knowledge, it was promoted back in the 50s and 60s, or excuse me, in the 60s and 70s by the John Birch Society, which was heavily funded by Fred Koch, the Koch brothers' father. Now, whether he had anything to do with it or not, I don't have any clue.
You know what I'm talking about having somebody look down on somebody and they'll forget, they'll let the other guy pick your pocket? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's what it seems like white privilege does.
Well, hang on just a second. Maybe we're talking about different quotes. The one I'm thinking of that I have heard so many times from right-wingers was they argue that LBJ, the basis of his Great Society programs, was that if you gave black people something like food or shelter, they will vote for you forever and never ask for anything more.
You tried to read my mind on that one. No, I was just talking about if you let one segment of the society, he was talking about white people, I'm assuming, look down on another set of a society, it'll let the rich guys pick their pocket.
Oh, okay. Derek, my apologies. Go ahead. I've got to stop interrupting people. Go for it.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah. I don't remember, him saying it, but I've read it before, and I don't know if it's true or not, but, it sounds good.
I don't know if he said it or not, but I think that it makes a lot of sense because white privilege tends to be a distraction. It tends to keep the dominant society ignorant of what's really going on. And plus, they were enslaved. The Europeans were slaving Europeans before they started importing them, right?
Yep.
I'm assuming.
Yep.
So it keeps them in this fog of thinking their skin's going to protect them from capitalist interest, and it ain't.
Yeah. Well, and Europe had a long history of slavery, of same race slavery. I mean, as well as slavery across races. So
right. And this indoctrination of I'm gonna say white supremacy. I can't think of another word that also keeps them asleep.
Yeah,
I think because remember, child labor laws wasn't about race.
Yeah,
was state.
It was about the money.
That white privilege is an opiate of sorts.
I agree. And the solution to white privilege, much like the solution to straight privilege or male privilege, is for white people to wake up to it, to acknowledge it, to recognize it.
At that 99%, I think the white privilege fractures that 99%, man. If people believe that the 1% is all white, they're like stupid because they're not. And
but the white percent, the 1% is overwhelmingly white.
Yeah, I know they're overwhelmingly white, but I don't call Arabs white. You know, they're Semites, and plus there's some really rich, Africans down there. Whether they got it right or not is beside the point.
Right.
All they care about is the power.
Yeah, you're talking worldwide. Yeah, Derek, thanks for the call. Good point. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today? Oh, let me try pushing the button again. That button didn't work. Let me try this button. Oh, man. I wonder if I open this Telos software and we look at line 3, which is where Paul is. I wonder if I can have both of these open at the same time and see what. That doesn't seem to work either. Yeah, not responding. Okay, I got to cancel out of that. I got a mess here. Anyhow, let me. We'll deal with this at the bottom of the hour. We're gonna have to reset all the phones and everything. As so often happens in the third hour of the program, I think what's going on is that our internet provider, which is one of those giant corporations, just. Yeah, connection to the server could not be established. Cancel. This is nuts. Lori put Paul on the line? Oh, it's down. Her system is down too. Oh, okay. All right. Let me then just pull some of this stuff together. And like I said, we will. In fact, I'm going to quit out of my. Tell Lori I'm quitting out of my call screening software right now. And have her quit and reboot, and we will do this whole thing all over again. And my apologies for those of you who are calling. You may be, in all probability are going to have to call back at the bottom of the hour. The United States was not founded as a Christian nation. Let's just put that on the table. The United States, in fact, Thomas Jefferson took the New Testament and literally, like with a razor blade, cut out of it all of the miracles, all of Jesus' miracles in the first four Gospels, the story of Jesus, and published it as the Jefferson Bible, and it's still in print. No miracles, no divine Jesus. Jefferson was not a Christian. He was proud of not being a Christian. The father of the Declaration of Independence. But beyond that, I mean, that's almost a specious argument, because Jefferson has been dead for a couple of hundred years, or nearly 180 years. The larger issue here is you know, where does bigotry begin and end, whether it's with regard to gay people or people of color or women, or, I mean, you fill in the blanks. And what do we do about it? And it seems to me that the privilege that has been enjoyed by and large, straight white men all these years has to be acknowledged by straight white men and everybody else. But white society as a whole, and particularly in the United States, I would say even Christian white society, needs to wake up. And by the way, I put myself in that category. I am still learning and still growing and still discovering things and occasionally being horrified by things about myself that I look at and go, what the hell was I thinking? Anyhow, Alex McFarland. Boy, I'm going to have to reboot my entire computer, which I'm going to do right now. So there's a few other things that I wanted to share with you today that I thought were fascinating. And one of them, force restart, yes, please. One of them is this statistician. I mentioned this briefly yesterday afternoon, but I think I have seen nothing about this anyplace else. And I think it's really worth checking out. It's really worth, you know, figuring out what is going on with this. This Wichita State University in Kansas, statistician, she's got a PhD in statistics. She knows what she's doing, and she's looking at the election outcomes and going, as the demographics of these cities change and the voting patterns change, the voting patterns are not changing in a way that's consistent with the demographic patterns, particularly in the cities, and it looks like there's a vote-flipping algorithm in some of these voting machines. How bizarre and how weird is that? And the other one, we were talking about white privilege. The other, on the internet in particular, talk about male privilege. In the Twitter sphere, sick and tired of being called fat and ugly and receiving rape threats. This is from Bustle.com. And receiving reprinted over at Democratic Underground by Boston Bean. Sick and tired of being called fat and ugly and receiving rape threats whenever she participated in conversations about injustice on social media, Alex Blank Millard decided to try an experiment. For a week, she changed her Twitter profile picture to a man's headshot, which her name lent itself to, her name being Alex, and continued to tweeting about topics like sexism, racism, and fat shaming. And the difference in her public reception after that simple change was staggering. Writing for XO, Jane Millard said, and I quote, "For an entire week, I got to see what it is like to be treated with respect. As a man, I could use the same words and be met with discussion, with disagreement, or even nothing at all instead of insults. I became an equal human being, one whose voice deserved to be heard." While tweeting as a woman, Millard got replies like, "You are fat, unattractive, and a disgrace to the white race." But as a man, she was able to tweet about rape culture with only favorites and retweets in response. BuzzFeed even used an example. A screenshot of one of her tweets is the first example of public response to the shooting of a Latina girl by cops. Strange choice given that she appeared to be a white man, she noted. Which raises another question altogether, which is skinny privilege, attractive privilege. I mean, now we're seeing pushback and a substantial pushback, frankly. And I think it's, again, a healthy thing of women of size. I'm not sure what the appropriate way to say that doesn't sound hurtful, but women who are larger than, you know, this the cultural norm or whatever. Being embraced and being marketed to. Well, that's a good first step. But all these different types of privilege kind of compile on top of each other, concatenate on top of each other, and ultimately lead to things like, you know, Walter Scott getting shot in South Carolina. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we're going to do our best here during this break to try and make our phones work. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you, giving up on our newfangled software and going to the old-fashioned stuff that came with the Telos machine so I could get you on the air. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm using the software that we started this program with 11 years ago now.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
There you go. There you go.
Oh, so your guest pulled a fast one on you there, Tom.
How so?
He said, and this is a tactic, you have to be ready for this one. You wouldn't expect a homosexual man who owns a print shop to print for the Westboro Baptist Church a flyer that says God hates fags.
Right.
That's a fast one, and you know why? Because that printer wouldn't print that flyer for anybody, not just the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh.
You see, this is what they're doing. What they're doing is they're trying to appeal to what they think people would be sympathetic to the left.
Right.
So they'll flip it around and say, you wouldn't expect a Muslim T-shirt make silkscreen T-shirt maker to make a T-shirt that has an image of defiling the image of Muhammad on it. No, because I wouldn't expect him to make that for anyone, not just some Christian. Or how about you wouldn't expect someone to make a cake in the shape of a sex organ? No, I wouldn't expect for anybody. Or how about this one? This isn't even religion. You wouldn't expect somebody who's against guns to make a cake in the shape of a gun, would you? No, he wouldn't make that for anybody, for the NRA, for the NRA party, right? No, it doesn't matter who the customer is. If the purveyor wouldn't make it for anybody, it's not discrimination.
That is such a brilliant and clear point. I learned from you, Paul. I really do.
They keep doing this. This is their tactic. They've been doing this ever since, and they pull it and they try to. When you hear something sympathetic to the left, that's the setup. They're conflating the service with the customer.
Yeah. My response to him was, you know, if they're trying to assert their right to be a bigot to the Westboro Baptist Church, I'm no more in favor of that than somebody being a bigot to a gay couple. But you're right. That's the much, much weaker argument than the argument that, you know, printing something that is patently offensive, that has a slur word on it, that presumably at some point in the future will be, you know, it's like the N-word, you know, has gone from being something that was said on national television 50 years ago to radio where now it's verboten. The same thing with the F word that you're talking about, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church word, to say, no, it's offensive. I'm not going to print it for anybody. Yeah.
Right. It doesn't matter who the customer is.
Yeah.
I have another one here. This is another setup is they're conflating. This is the thing that the United States was founded on Christian principles.
Right.
And their evidence is, yes, the founding fathers were all, I heard someone yesterday on another show say, they were all born-again Christians.
Exist back then, by the way.
Right, exactly. That's
the whole concept of born-again Christianity was invented, wasn't it, the late 19th century?
About mid-evangelicalism in this country was about the 1870s.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there was this whole burst, you know, Ellen White and all these others, and yeah.
Yeah.
Amy Semple McPherson.
I've had this exercise, and I start this way. Okay, let's check that out. First, list some Christian principles for me. They struggle with that. List some Christian principles that are uniquely Christian. Okay.
Right.
The next step is now let's see where we find those in the Constitution.
Right.
Is that very easy to do?
Well, if you say uniquely Christian, it's impossible to do because, as Thomas Jefferson said. You know, one of the great frauds of the clergy is that, you know, it was he was going off on David Hume, who was the British historian of his time, you know, of Jefferson's mm-hmm. time. And Hume had said that British common law was a consequence of Christianity. And this was in the 1870s. And Jefferson says you might as well have said that the theory of gravity was part, you know, that they could, you know, the British common law was based on that. I mean, actually, he phrased it much better than what I'm saying. But the point that he made was that British common law existed for 200 years before England was conquered by Christians. Before the first right. king of the Heptarchy became a Christian. And so for 200 years, you had what we would describe or what Christians would describe as a pagan country with pagan religions for 200 years officially operating. And that was the basis of English common law. And Jefferson's right. Jefferson said, you know, this is one of the great frauds of the clergy.
Well and the other thing is true, too, that the people who want to assert that the country was founded, the United States was founded on Christianity. They want to cast out Thomas Jefferson because they know his history.
Oh, yeah.
They say, but most of them were. The other thing that Alex McFarland brought up is that says that societies can't run void of morality. But that doesn't – morality, not all morality is necessarily based in Christianity or religion. There's morality that's based in the Enlightenment, in rationality and reason.
Well, and that's, again, Jefferson in that same letter, he said, we did not need
right. –
You know, speaking of when they wrote the Declaration and the Constitution, he said, we did not need to look into musty parchments or ancient times to find, I forget the phrase he used, but basically, you know, the basis for our nation and our laws. He said, we looked in nature and in our hearts and found it carved there. In other words, these, you know, morality is intrinsic to humanity.
Right, correct. Yeah, it's part of. And so a lot of this conflating of issue, or I don't want to say issues, what's the word, conflating of concepts that because some of the founding, and who are the founding, how many founding fathers are there? Because, you know, there were actually probably thousands rather than hundreds
yeah.
of people who could be considered founding fathers, and to say that they all shared exactly the same religious belief is ridiculous because they
right.
for certainly did not.
Right.
And that's why the Constitution was written in such vague terms. Is because they had to please sort of everybody.
Well, and even among the Christians, there was huge internecine warfare. I mean, the Christians in Massachusetts were constantly at war with the Christians in Pennsylvania, for example.
Right.
I mean, you know, the old Puritans and Pilgrims, you know, kind of the modern day fundamentalist Baptists, whatever you want to call them, versus the Congregationalists and Pentecostal, or not Congregationalists and Presbyterians, and then you had the kind of what even then were considered the kind of slightly off to the side, not quite, you know, mainstream Christianity groups like the Universalists or the Quakers, you know, actually the Quakers, you know, actually very highly respected, except in Massachusetts where they were hated. So excellent.
I would say that just because some of them were Christians, therefore the Constitution was founded on Christian principles. Again, I go to list the Christian principles that you're talking about, and then let's go through the Constitution article by article.
Yeah.
Through the amendments and
yeah, please tell
out.
Me one. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Paul. You have
fun.
You have set up my next debate. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Mike in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Mike, what's up?
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Two points and a guest suggestion.
Okay.
Okay. Can I do the guest suggestion first?
Sure. Whatever you'd like.
Okay. The new John Brown. You need to have Tim Wise on as a guest.
Okay.
If you pull him up on YouTube, he explains, he goes around to white schools and explains white privilege.
Did you mean Jim Brown or Jim Crow?
No, John Brown.
John Brown.
John Brown.
Oh, okay.
Tim Wise is the new John Brown.
Yeah, as in the ferry.
Okay.
Yeah. Got it.
Yes. And the first point on white privilege.
Yes, sir.
Any minority, any person of color, both male and female, and a white woman, they cannot say no to a white male, either straight or gay. It's like oil and water, okay? It doesn't happen.
like the young lady, I think her name was Ann, that called earlier. She said, if I would have, as a secretary, if I would have said no, I would have been fired.
Right. She was talking about being a woman in a law firm in the 70s and having to get the coffee for the
If you go to and see, watch 12 Years a Slave and think about Sally Hemings from Jefferson.
Yep.
No black woman of that day, even black male, would have contemplated saying no. Ever.
And the few who did were typically murdered.
Yes, it would have been over.
Yeah.
Okay, and the reason why the gay and lesbian movement has moved at miraculous speed is because it's run by white males, and you don't tell white males no, or you're going to get conflict. You're going to get pushback. It just doesn't happen. White males can tell anybody else no.
Yeah. So
I am
in agreement with your hypothesis. What do we do about it? It seems to me that step one is to wake up white males in particular, but white people in general, to white privilege, straight privilege, Christian privilege in this country. I mean, there's a bunch of these different things, you know, where the institutional power structures are stacked on behalf of particular people. What's your solution?
I think the interracial marriage, interracial love, and the sperm are going to be the answer to this issue.
So as we get to know each other, as we work together, as we love each other, as we marry each other, that's very idealistic, Mike, and I love the idea. I hope it's true. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And let's see here. I'm trying to figure out who's most likely watching on Free Speech TV based on where they're calling from. Les in Ridgefield, New Jersey. Are you watching on Free Speech TV?
No, I'm listening to you on TuneIn.
Oh, well, that's cool. We're on the air right now. So what's up?
Oh, a few things. I actually started to call about the cold-blooded murder by that killer cop in South Carolina.
Of Walter Scott.
Among many others. Yeah. And I've actually called a couple shows this morning about the same topic. The problem with this thing is it all goes back down to racism. And by racism, I don't mean I hate you because you're black or you're Hispanic or whatever. It's one group has the power, and everybody else is in a race to get that power.
Right.
That group currently is white people. And I hear you say about, you know, white people need to wake up. I don't really think there's no need. I don't think there's a wake-up call for white people. They know they have what they have.
Yeah, Les.
They don't want to give it up.
No, Les. I got to tell you, as a white guy, you know, I spent half my life not having any idea what the hell white privilege was. Probably more than half my life, and I talk to other white people, and you know, most of the callers to this program are white people, and I'm telling you, I would be astonished if even 5% of white Americans understand just the basic stuff of white privilege, that white people don't wake up every morning knowing that, you know, thinking about their race, for example, and how is that going to influence this day? Back to you.
I'll give you that. I would never say that. I would never paint with a broad brush. The same way I wouldn't say that all police are bad, but
right.
At the same time, the original. My main topic that I called in on has been changed about 15 different times just through listening to you talk to the different callers and adding different pieces into it. So I want to get back to my main thing.
Okay.
My main thing is that police or the police departments of this country have been infiltrated by white supremacists.
Infiltrated? They were built by them, Les. The police were originally created, I mean, in large part, in many places, the police were literally originally the slave patrols.
Right. And now what we have is a new lynching now, whereas you can, instead of putting on a hood and riding around terrorizing people, you can hide behind a badge, kill people at will, claim it in the line of duty, and be protected by the state.
Yep.
And even in situations like Ferguson, Missouri, where, all right, Darren Wilson, he got off from being charged, but he's no longer a cop. But the same racist system with this GoFundMe or whatever they use that crowdsource funding made him a millionaire.
Yeah.
So there's rewards for lynching. And this is the new Jim Crow. The rewards for lynching, and you put, instead of riding around on horses with hoods, you put the badge on and you go out and shoot people in cold blood.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about that, it seems so easy to reverse, is police are protected by the state. If you sue a police department, say, for example, this man's family sues the police department, especially in that state, because I believe they have a cap of $300,000 is a max you could sue anybody, anything in that state.
So there's it's a tort reform state. Yeah. Not a good thing. Les, we're out of time, but thank you for your contribution. Excellent comments all. And thank you for calling and for listening. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk about your guest that was on, Mr. McFarland.
Mm-hmm.
He kept talking about the First Amendment, using that as, for his points he was trying to make. And I just wanted to point out that the First Amendment also addresses the separation of church and state in reference to the Establishment Clause, the freedom from religion, and the Free Exercise Clause, the right to practice religion. That doesn't say anything about discriminating in business against using religious beliefs.
Correct, although the Supreme Court has dragged us into that territory with the Hobby Lobby decision for the first time in the history of our country.
Yeah, and they've also, among other decisions they've made. Choice matter for sexual orientation, to me, that's not a choice, but the practice of religion, or even acknowledgement of God, or belief or non-belief in God, is a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And why should their choice trump my choice? Again, I don't believe, other than for a very, very small minority of people who are bisexual, I don't believe that gender attraction is a choice. I believe that it's something that we're built with, or that we're born with, and not that we're built with. So it's a thin argument to say your religious choice combats my, or shouldn't have the power to do my choice about who I want to marry or be with. But I go way beyond that. I think for the vast majority, probably well over, from what I've seen, the science I've seen, probably well over 98-97% of people in gay relationships, it was not a choice. It's how they've been their whole entire lives. It's just who they are. Dave, thank you for the call. Is it Tegan in Utah?
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, how are you?
Good. I wanted to make a point just to kind of piggyback on a previous caller's comment about your statement that print shops, if they're in the business of making signs, that they should, caller said, he kind of got you there. He had a gotcha moment.
Yeah, you're right.
My point is that not only do I agree with the previous caller, but there's a fundamental difference between asking a baker to make their cake or a pizza shop to make their cake. You're not asking for anything special, and then asking a sign shop to make something that creates a hostile work environment for the people that own it and for the people that work there.
Another.
I don't think anyone can argue that making a cake or making a pizza for anything, unless you're, like he was mentioning, making a cake in the shape of a gun or in the shape of genitals or something like that. I don't think anyone can argue making just a cake.
What if you owned a cake shop and somebody came along and said, we're doing a birthday party for Dick Cheney, would you make the cake? I'm joking. I'm sorry, Tegan. I'm joking.
You'd have to.
I know, you'd have to. I know. It's there are times when you want to discriminate, though. What? Really? Dick Cheney?
What I'm saying is that there's a difference between, so what I'm saying is that you can't ask a sign shop to make a God hates fags sign.
Right.
If it's owned by gay people, your previous caller was right. They wouldn't make that for anybody. So
that's correct. It shouldn't be made for anybody. And let's just for the future reference, let's try not to use that word on the show. But excellent point, Tegan. Excellent point. Thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Lisa in West Rutland, Vermont. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
I do agree that, with your previous caller, but I have a point is if they are going to discriminate against gays, then they should discriminate against strippers, bigamists, ex-cons, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists.
Well, and a church can do that, Lisa. A church.
Exactly.
You know,
a church can, right.
Sure. The Catholic Church can say to Rudy. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. If they're going to discriminate, then they should discriminate equally. Do they have a sign saying we only cater to people of insert your religion here? You know, what is their religion?
Right. Right. But, religions are basically, there's the First Amendment protection, but beyond that, they're basically, religions are religions. It's a unique thing. But to say that
right.
a business is a religion, that a business has a religion, that's just craziness.
I
it's
know.
Just totally...
If that's what they're well, that's their point of not doing the wedding for the gay couple.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's religious. It's against their religion.
There
well, then, so are Buddhists or whatever else that isn't their religion. So you know, they're not a church. They're a pizza place. And are they not going to do a strippers party or
right.
you know are they going to check
are they
let me see your credentials
refuse to serve Rudy Giuliani because he's been divorced twice
exactly they don't like it
yeah
nope.
Okay I got to move along here Lisa but thank you for the call great to hear from you I appreciate it Rick in Los Angeles hey Rick what's up
hi I didn't hear my name but I think you're calling
yep
talking
Rick
assertion that the Judeo-Christian underpinnings of our Constitution, actually, they're similar to the ancient wisdom and cycle of action that the founding fathers had privy to because they were enlightened.
Yes.
So you'll find that it's organized on the same principles. Some of the Psalms are organized on the letters of the. Hebrew alphabet. They have the same organization, you know, through start, change, stop. That's an old Vedic hymn organization So
your point, Rick.
Yeah, they're organized the same way, but Judeo-Christian underpinnings is not what's the...
No, I think morality... Thank you, Rick, for the call. Morality is morality. Morality is, and it's not just human, by the way. Animals treat each other well, right? I mean, right down to literally rats and mice. If you overfeed one in the presence of another, they get offended. The science on this is just amazing. Morality is wired into us. Anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you participating. Tag your. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.